Buckle up, everybody, because today we are going deep, way back in time, to explore prehistoric India.
Really deep.
Yeah, we're talking 7,000 to 1,500 BCE.
The time before all those grand empires and dynasties we usually picture when we think about India.
Exactly, like no Taj Mahal or anything yet, right?
Right, but it's still a period that's absolutely crucial for understanding the foundations of human existence on the subcontinent.
Okay, so no fancy palaces, but we must have some kind of sources to work with.
Well, archaeology is our best friend here.
So digging up those ancient cities?
Not quite cities yet, but definitely digging.
Okay, so more like piecing together clues.
Yeah, think of it like a puzzle with pieces of pottery tools, the remains of settlements.
It's amazing what those little traces can tell us about how these early communities lived.
Absolutely. We can learn about how they worked, what they ate, even how they expressed themselves through art and rituals.
It's like being a detective of the ancient world, trying to reconstruct a whole civilization from these little fragments.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what's fascinating is that the sources for this particular deep dive are kind of a curveball.
Oh, how so?
Well, they focus heavily on how the British viewed India much later in the 18th century.
The British, so like after the East India Company had already established itself.
Exactly. So we're not looking directly at prehistoric sources, but rather at how a later culture interpreted and sometimes misinterpreted their own past.
Hold on. So you're saying that these 18th century British perspectives can actually shed light on prehistoric communities thousands of years earlier?
That's the idea. It might seem counterintuitive, but it's all about understanding the lens of historical interpretation. You see, the British were really fixated on the idea of an ancient constitution.
An ancient constitution?
Yeah, basically this idea that there was this pre-existing set of laws and traditions that had governed India for centuries before they arrived.
I guess that makes sense. They wanted to legitimize their own rule.
Exactly. They were trying to frame themselves as restorers of an ancient order, not as some new imposing force.
Clever PR move. But I still don't see how that connects back to prehistoric India.
Well, this British quest for an ancient constitution led to some pretty skewed interpretations of Indian history.
Right. How?
They tended to oversimplify things, creating this binary view of Muslim conquerors and Hindu subjects, which just doesn't reflect the reality of how complex Indian society was, especially during the Mughal period.
Ah, so they were fitting history into a neat little box that suited their agenda.
Exactly. And that same kind of oversimplification could have happened with even earlier cultures.
So we need to be extra careful about taking historical narratives at face value. There are always layers of interpretation, even when we're talking about prehistory.
Absolutely. And that's something we'll keep coming back to as we delve into these sources.
But before we do that, can you give us a little background on the East India Company? How did a trading company become such a dominant force in India?
Well, their rise to power was surprisingly swift.
Really?
They started as a humble trading company in the 17th century, but by the 18th century, they had gained control of Bengal.
Wow, from merchants to rulers. Bengal was a major region, right?
Oh, absolutely. A huge economic and cultural hub. And this control they exerted wasn't just symbolic. They controlled the administration. They collected taxes.
And all this with a relatively small number of actual Brits on the ground.
That's the fascinating part. They relied heavily on a large Indian military force, and they had to collaborate with local elites to some extent.
So they needed the expertise of the people they were trying to rule.
In a way, yes. They had to engage with existing systems of governance, learn about local customs and practices.
That must have been a complex relationship to navigate trying to assert control while also relying on the knowledge of those you're trying to subordinate.
Exactly. And it's a dynamic that raises all sorts of questions about power, knowledge, and representation.
Like whose voices are we actually hearing in these historical records?
Exactly. And it's something we need to keep in mind as we go deeper, because remember, we're looking at India's past through a very specific lens, one shaped by colonialism and this quest for an ancient constitution.
Okay, so we've got this skewed historical narrative created by the British. But how does that actually help us understand the real prehistoric communities in India? Are there parallels between how they viewed the Mughals and how later cultures might have viewed those even earlier societies?
Well, the British initially saw the Mughals with a sort of mix of respect and apprehension.
That makes sense. They were a powerful empire.
Exactly. They recognized the Mughals as a sophisticated and enduring force with complex systems of governance. But as time went on, those views got simplified.
Leading to that oversimplified binary of Hindu and Muslim that we talked about.
Exactly. And a similar kind of simplification could have happened with the interpretation of even earlier cultures.
So it's like a game of historical telephone where the message gets distorted with each retelling.
That's a great way to put it, and it just goes to show how important it is to be critical of the sources we use to understand the past. We have to be aware of the biases and agendas that might have shaped those sources and be willing to challenge our own assumptions.
Okay, so we've established that interpreting history is a tricky business, especially when dealing with prehistory. But let's dive into what we do know about those early communities. We know the Indian subcontinent has a long history of human habitation. But where do we find the very earliest traces of that presence?
One of the most significant finds comes from the Stone Valley in present-day Pakistan.
Stone Valley, okay. Wow. And what did they find there?
Stone tools dating back as far as 500,000 years ago.
500,000 years. That's incredible. But that's well before the period we're focusing on, right?
It is, but it's important to remember that prehistory is a long and continuous story.
Right. So those early tool makers were setting the stage for everything that came after.
Exactly. They were the pioneers adapting to a changing environment and laying the groundwork for the cultures that would follow.
So let's fast forward a bit to the period we are focusing on, 7,000 to 1500 BCE. What were those communities like? Were they still wandering around or had they started to settle down?
That's where things get really interesting. By this time, we see clear evidence of a shift towards more settled ways of life.
A shift towards settlements. So were they building villages, farming?
Exactly. We start to see the emergence of agriculture, the domestication of animals, and more permanent structures.
So what prompted this shift? Did they just decide they were tired of wandering around?
Well, a changing climate likely played a role.
Like the end of the last ice age.
Exactly. Around 10,000 BCE, the climate started to warm and become wetter, which made it more favorable for agriculture.
So a bit of environmental pressure pushing them towards a new way of life.
You could say that, and this shift wasn't uniform. Of course, some groups remain nomadic, but we see a growing trend towards settled communities across the subcontinent.
And are there any particular sites from this period that stand out?
Absolutely. Mehrgarh in present-day Pakistan is a real gem.
Mehrgarh. I've heard that name before. Isn't it considered one of the earliest farming communities in the world?
It is. It dates back to around 7,000 BCE, and it offers some incredible insights into that transition from nomadic life to settled agriculture.
So what kind of things have they found at Mehrgarh?
Well, for starters, they've uncovered the remains of mud brick houses.
So they were building permanent structures.
Exactly. And not just houses. They also found evidence of domesticated animals like sheep and goats.
So they were raising livestock as well as cultivating crops. It's starting to sound like a real village.
It was. And here's something that might surprise you. They even found evidence of early dentistry at Mehrgarh.
Wait, dentistry like 9,000 years ago?
Oh, no, it's amazing. They were already using flint tools to drill and fill teeth.
That's some seriously advanced dental work for such an early community.
Mm.
So we've got farming houses, livestock, dentistry. It seems like they were doing pretty well for themselves.
They were, and they weren't just surviving, they were thriving. They were developing new technologies, experimenting with different materials, and creating a rich and vibrant culture.
So it wasn't just about scraping by, they were innovating and pushing boundaries.
Exactly. And as we explore other sites from this period, we'll see even more evidence of their ingenuity and creativity, from their intricate pottery designs to their complex burial rituals.
Okay, you've definitely piqued my curiosity. I'm ready to see what other secrets these early communities left behind.
Well then, let's dive in and see what we can uncover together. Welcome back to our prehistoric adventure.
It's pretty mind-blowing to think about how different the landscape must have been back then.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a time when even the course of the Indus River might have been completely different.
The Indus River, wow. And that river played such a crucial role in the development of the Indus Valley civilization.
Exactly. It was their lifeline. And imagine this, the Thar Desert, which we now picture as this vast expanse of dry land.
Yeah.
Well, back then it was likely much greener and more fertile.
So these early communities weren't just dealing with the usual survival challenges. They were also adapting to a constantly shifting environment.
Exactly. They had to be incredibly resourceful and resilient to make it in those conditions.
Like a never-ending test of their adaptability. How do they manage?
Well, they had to master water management, for one thing.
Makes sense, especially with a changing climate.
Right. And they had to be able to find new food sources as the landscape transformed around them.
It sounds like they were constantly on their toes, having to adjust to new challenges.
They were. And you know what? That constant adaptation actually played a key role in shaping their culture.
Oh, how so?
It forced them to be creative, to experiment, to come up with new technologies and practices to survive.
So necessity really was the mother of invention.
You could say that. So let's talk about those technologies we touched on, agriculture and crafts, in the last part.
Right. But I'm curious about the specific tools and techniques they were using.
Well, you can't talk about prehistoric India or really the Stone Age in general without talking about stone tools.
Stone tools, it's easy to think of them as primitive, but they were the cutting-edge technology of their time, right?
Exactly like the smartphones of the Stone Age. Each tool was carefully crafted for a specific purpose, and the variety we find in the archaeological record is amazing.
So it wasn't just one generic stone tool for everything.
Oh no, not at all. You've got hand axes for heavy-duty work, like chopping wood or butchering animals.
Right, I can picture that.
Then you've got scrapers for cleaning hides and points for hunting or fishing.
Wow, so each one tells a story about the task it was used for.
Exactly, and it also speaks to the knowledge and skill of the person who made it.
It's mind-blowing to think that something as simple as a chipped piece of stone can give us a window into the lives of these ancient people.
It really is, and as we move towards the end of the Stone Age and into the Bronze Age, the techniques become even more refined.
So, like how?
Well, we start to see grinding and polishing, which allowed them to create finer, more specialized tools.
So it wasn't just about bashing rocks together.
Not at all. It was a true craft passed down through generations, each generation adding their own innovations.
It's like a chain of knowledge stretching back through time.
That's a great way to put it. And those stone tools weren't the only technology they were mastering. We also find evidence of pottery weaving and even early metallurgy.
Metallurgy.
Yeah.
So they were already working with metals?
Yeah.
That's pretty advanced.
It is. It starts with copper, which is relatively easy to work with.
Okay.
We see copper tools at sites like Merigar, showing that they were already experimenting with this new material.
So what were they using those copper tools for?
Probably a mix of things: tools, weapons, ornaments.
So it wasn't just practical stuff. They were also using metal for decoration and maybe even ritual purposes.
Exactly. And as their skills developed, they would eventually move on to bronze, which is an alloy of copper and tin.
Bronze, that opens up a whole new world of possibilities.
It does. Bronze is stronger and more durable than copper, so it allowed them to create even more sophisticated tools and objects.
So were they making swords and shields and all that?
We do find evidence of early weapons, but they also used bronze for things like tools, ornaments, and ritual objects.
So it's a real mix of the practical and the symbolic.
Exactly, and it shows how they were taking this new material and adapting it to their existing needs and traditions.
You mentioned pottery earlier, too. I'm curious about that. When did pottery first appear on the scene in India?
Pottery pops up around the same time as those early copper tools, around 7000 BCE.
Wow, so it's a real period of technological innovation.
It is, and pottery was a game changer. It revolutionized the way they stored food and water, cooked their meals, even expressed themselves artistically.
Oh, right, the decorated pots. I've seen images of those. Some of them are stunning, intricate patterns, animal motifs, even what look like gods and goddesses.
Exactly. It wasn't just about practicality, it was about beauty and meaning.
So those pots are like windows into their beliefs and worldview?
Precisely, those designs give us clues about their cultural values, their understanding of the cosmos, their relationship with the natural world.
It makes you wonder if they ever sat around admiring a newly decorated pot and felt that same sense of pride and accomplishment that we feel when we create something beautiful today.
I'm sure they did. That human urge to create, to express ourselves through art is timeless.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've got tools, pottery, metalwork, all this amazing innovation happening. But what about their spiritual lives? Those cave paintings at Bimbetka were incredible, but are there other clues about their beliefs and rituals?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the most fascinating places to explore those beliefs is through their burial practices.
Burial practices, you mean like how they buried their dead?
Exactly. The way they treated their dead tells us a lot about what they believed about the afterlife and the relationship between the living and the dead.
Okay, so where do we find evidence of these burial practices?
Well, there's a site called Burzahome in the Kashmir Valley that's particularly intriguing.
Okay, what's so special about this site?
At Burzahome, we find something called pit burials.
Pit burial. So they were burying their dead in pits.
Exactly. Now, burying people in pits isn't unique in itself.
Right.
But what's interesting here is that the deceased were often buried in a flex position with their knees drawn up towards their chest.
A flex position. I wonder why they did that.
That's what archaeologists are trying to figure out.
Any theories?
Well, some suggest it symbolizes rebirth or a return to the womb of Mother Earth.
That's fascinating. It's like they were sending them back to where they came from.
And the mystery deepens when we look at the objects they were buried with.
Right. Grave goods like tools, pottery, personal items. What kind of things did they find at Burzahome?
We find a fascinating mix of items, and it varies a lot from burial to burial.
So some had more elaborate grave goods than others.
Exactly, which might tell us something about their social status or their role in the community.
Okay, that makes sense.
Some burials included red ochre, which is a pigment often associated with ritual practices.
Red ochre, so it had symbolic significance.
Exactly. And others included animal bones, which might suggest a belief in animal sacrifice or providing sustenance for the afterlife.
It's like each burial is a personalized time capsule, offering a glimpse into their beliefs and the social structures of their community.
That's a great way to put it. And there are a few standout burials that have really captivated archaeologists.
No, like what?
Well, one burial contained a large number of polished stone axes.
Polished stone axes. That sounds like a person of high status or maybe a skilled craftsperson.
Exactly. And in another burial, they found the remains of a dog buried alongside its human companion.
Oh, a dog burial that's so touching, it speaks to that deep bond between humans and animals.
It really does. And those are just a few examples. As we explore other sites, we find even more evidence of the complexity and diversity of their burial practices, reflecting a range of beliefs about the afterlife and the relationship between the living and the dead.
It's incredible how these ancient rituals, these practices that might seem so foreign to us today, can offer such profound insights into the human experience.
It's a reminder that even though they lived thousands of years ago, they were grappling with many of the same fundamental questions that we still ask ourselves today.
Questions about life,
Yeah.
the meaning of it all.
Exactly. And those questions are timeless. They transcend cultural boundaries and connect us to these ancient communities in a very real way.
Okay, so we're back and ready to tackle those megalithic structures you mentioned.
Megaliths, yeah, they're pretty amazing.
I mean, we've already covered so much ground, from those early stone tools to sophisticated settlements like Mergar.
The incredible cave paintings at Bimbetka.
Oh, and those burial practices at Burzahom.
It's been quite a journey.
It really has. And now we're about to encounter these massive stone structures.
Structures that have stood the test of time.
Exactly. So before we get into their significance, can we just back up a bit? What exactly are megaliths and what were they used for?
Sure. So the word megalith literally means big stone.
Okay, makes sense.
And they're found all over the world, these large stone structures, each with its own unique purpose and form.
And in India, we see a pretty wide variety of them,
Right.
right?
Oh, yeah. An incredible range dating back to the late Stone Age and early Bronze Age.
Because we're talking about structures built by the same communities we've been discussing all along.
Exactly the same folks who are mastering agriculture, creating those beautiful pots.
Developing new technologies.
Right. So, what are some of the most common types of megaliths we find in India?
Yeah, and what can they tell us about the people who built them?
Well, one of the most common types is the dolmen.
Dolmen.
Yeah, imagine a giant stone table.
Okay, I can picture that.
That's essentially what a dolmen is. They often served as burial chambers.
So, like a stone tomb.
Exactly. And sometimes you find them clustered together in what are called dolmen fields.
Wow, a whole field of these ancient tombs. That must be an incredible sight.
Oh, it is. And those dolmens often contain grave goods, pottery tools, personal items.
Right, like we talked about with Burzahom.
Exactly. Those grave goods give us clues about their beliefs, their social structures, all sorts of things.
It's like each dolmen is a window into the past, a portal to another time.
That's a great way to put it.
So we've got dolmens. What else?
Well, another common type is the cairn.
Cairn.
Yeah, basically a mound of stones piled over a burial or other significant site.
It's kind of like a marker.
Exactly. They can range in size from small, simple structures to massive, elaborate constructions.
So it's like they're saying, hey, something important happened here.
Exactly. They're marking the spot for future generations.
Okay, what about menhirs?
Yeah.
I remember you mentioned those earlier. How are they different from dolmens and cairns?
Menhirs are single upright stones, often quite tall and slender.
So like a standing stone.
Exactly. And they were erected for a variety of purposes. Some might have served as markers for burial sites or territorial boundaries, while others could have had religious or ceremonial significance.
So it's like a giant exclamation point in the landscape.
That's a great way to picture it.
But here's the thing, building these megaliths, regardless of their type, must have taken a huge amount of effort.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about quarrying these massive stones, transporting them sometimes over long distances, and then lifting and positioning them with precision.
It's mind-boggling when you think about the technology they had available.
Right? No cranes, no bulldozers.
So how did they move those giant stones?
Oh, that's a question that continues to fascinate archaeologists, but we believe they used a combination of ingenuity, manpower, and probably some clever systems of levers, rollers, and ramps.
It makes you appreciate their problem-solving skills.
Absolutely, and their ability to work together towards a common goal.
Because you couldn't build something like that on your own.
Exactly. It would have required large-scale cooperation and organization.
So these weren't just small, isolated families. We're talking about communities coming together.
Exactly. And that's one of the key things that megaliths tell us about this period.
They point to the existence of more complex social structures.
Precisely. Maybe even some form of hierarchical leadership emerging.
So it's not just about survival anymore, it's about something more.
Right. We're starting to see the seeds of what would eventually become those great civilizations of India with their elaborate hierarchies and monumental architecture.
It's like they were laying the foundation for everything that came after.
Exactly. And those megalithic structures weren't just functional, they also often exhibit unique artistic features that reflect the cultural traditions of the communities that created them.
So it wasn't just about practicality, they were also expressing themselves through these structures.
Absolutely. We see carvings, engravings, geometric patterns, all sorts of things that give us a glimpse into their worldview.
So they were taking inspiration from the world around them, but also adding their own unique flair.
Exactly. That blending of the global and the local, that creative adaptation, it's a hallmark of Indian culture throughout history.
I love that it's like they were taking these ideas and making them their own.
Exactly. So we've got these incredible structures that tell us about their technological skills, their social organization, their artistic sensibilities, but why do they matter today?
Yeah, to remind us that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves.
Exactly. And beyond that connection to the past, those megaliths are also testaments to human ingenuity.
To our capacity for creativity and innovation.
Exactly. They stand as reminders of what we as humans are capable of achieving when we work together towards a common goal.
And that spirit of cooperation, that ability to overcome challenges and create something lasting, it's something we could really use a bit more of in our modern world.
I couldn't agree more. And, as we wrap up this deep dive into prehistoric India, I keep coming back to the idea of resilience.
Resilience.
These communities faced incredible challenges, a constantly changing environment, limited resources.
Yet they found ways not only to survive, but to thrive.
Exactly. They adapted, they innovated, they created art, they built communities, and they left behind a legacy that continues to inspire us today.
It's a powerful reminder that we're part of a much larger story, a story that stretches back thousands of years and connects us to generations past, present, and future.
And that story, with its lessons of resilience, ingenuity, and interconnectedness, has the power to guide us as we navigate the challenges of the 21st century.
So well said. Thank you for taking us on this incredible journey through prehistoric India.
It's been my pleasure. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those minds open to the wonders of the past and the possibilities of the future.